Kushner's assistant indicated that Kislyak was very insistent about securing a second meeting. Note 1147. Kushner told the office that he did not want to take another meeting because he had already decided Kislyak was not the right channel for him to communicate with Russia. So he arranged to have one of his assistants, Avi Berkowitz, meet with Kislyak in his stead. Note 1148. Although embassy official Sergei Kuznetsov wrote to Berkowitz that Kislyak thought it important to continue the conversation with Mr. Kushner in person, note 1149. Kislyak nonetheless agreed to meet instead with Berkowitz once it became apparent that Kushner was unlikely to take a meeting. Berkowitz met with Kislyak on December 12, 2016 at Trump Tower, note 1150. The meeting lasted only a few minutes, during which Kislyak indicated that he wanted Kushner to meet someone who had a direct line to Putin, Sergei Gerkov, the head of the Russian government-owned bank Vnesheekonombank, VEB. Kushner agreed to meet with Gerkov, note 1151. The one-on-one meeting took place the next day, December 13, 2016, at the Colony Capitol building in Manhattan, where Kushner had previously scheduled meetings, note 1152. VEB was and is the subject of Department of Treasury economic sanctions imposed in response to Russia's annexation of Crimea, note 1153. Kushner did not, however, recall any discussion during his meeting with Gerkov about the sanctions against VEB or sanctions more generally, note 1154. Kushner stated in an interview that he did not engage in any preparation for the meeting and that no one on the transition team even did a Google search for Gerkov's name, note 1155. At the start of the meeting, Gerkov presented Kushner with two gifts, a painting and a bag of soil from the town in Belarus where Kushner's family originated, note 1156. The accounts from Kushner and Gerkov differ as to whether the meeting was diplomatic or business in nature. Kushner told the office that the meeting was diplomatic, with Gerkov expressing disappointment with U.S.-Russia relations under President Obama and hopes for improved relations with the incoming administration. According to Kushner, although Gerkov told Kushner a little bit about his bank and made some statements about the Russian economy, the two did not discuss Kushner's companies or private business dealings of any kind. Note 1158. At the time of the meeting, Kushner Companies had a debt obligation coming due on the building it owned at 666 Fifth Avenue, and there had been public reporting both about efforts to secure lending on the property and possible conflicts of interest for Kushner arising out of his company's borrowing from foreign lenders. Note 1159. In contrast, in a 2017 public statement, VEB suggested Gerkov met with Kushner in Kushner's capacity as CEO of Kushner Companies for the purpose of discussing business rather than as part of a diplomatic effort. In particular, VEB characterized Gerkov's meeting with Kushner as part of a series of roadshow meetings with, quote, representatives of major U.S. banks and business circles, unquote, which included negotiations and discussions of the, quote, most promising business lines and sectors, unquote. Note 1160. Forsman, the investment bank executive mentioned in Volume 1, Sections 4.A.1 and 4.B.3 Supra, told the office that he met with Gerkov and VEB Deputy Chairman Nikolai Chekomsky in Moscow just before Gerkov left for New York to meet Kushner. According to Forsman, Gerkov and Chekomsky told him that they were traveling to New York to discuss post-election issues with U.S. financial institutions, that their trip was sanctioned by Putin, and that they would be reporting back to Putin upon their return. Note 1162. The investigation did not resolve the apparent conflict in the accounts of Kushner and Gerkov, or determine whether the meeting was diplomatic in nature, as Kushner stated, focused on business, as VEB's public statement indicated, or whether it involved some combination of those matters or other matters. Regardless, the investigation did not identify evidence that Kushner and Gerkov engaged in any substantive follow-up after the meeting. Rather, a few days after the meeting, Gerkov's assistant texted Kushner's assistant, quote, "Hi, please inform your side that the information about the meeting had a very positive response," end quote. Note 1163. Over the following weeks, the two assistants exchanged a handful of additional cordial texts. Note 1164. On February 8, 2017, Gerkov's assistant texted Kushner's assistant, Berkowitz, to try to set up another meeting, and followed up by text at least twice in the days that followed. Note 1165. According to Berkowitz, he did not respond to the meeting request in light of the press coverage regarding the Russia investigation, and did not tell Kushner about the meeting request. Note 1166. 5. Peter Ovens' outreach efforts to the transition team. In December 2016, weeks after the one-on-one meeting with Putin described in Volume 1, Section 4.B.1.B Supra, Peter Ovens attended what he described as a separate, all-hands, oligarch meeting between Putin and Russia's most prominent businessmen. Note 1167. As in Ovens' one-on-one meeting, a main topic of discussion at the oligarch meeting in December 2016 was the prospect of forthcoming U.S. economic sanctions. Note 1168. After the December 2016 all-hands meeting, Ovens tried to establish a connection to the Trump team. Ovens instructed Richard Burt to make contact with the incoming Trump administration. Burt was on the board of directors for Letter One, L1, another company headed by Ovens, and had done work for Alpha Bank. Note 1169. Burt had previously served as U.S. ambassador to Germany and Assistant Secretary of State for European and Canadian Affairs, and one of his primary roles with Alpha Bank and L1 was to facilitate introductions to business contacts in the United States and other Western countries. Note 1170. While at an L1 board meeting held in Luxembourg in late December 2016, Ovens pulled Burt aside and told him that he had spoken to someone high in the Russian government who expressed interest in establishing a communications channel between the Kremlin and the Trump transition team. Note 1171. Ovens asked for Burt's help in contacting members of the transition team. Note 1172. Although Burt had been responsible for helping Ovens build connections in the past, Burt viewed Ovens' request as unusual and outside the normal realm of his dealings with Ovens. Note 1173. Burt, who is a member of the board of CNI, discussed at Volume 1, Section 4.A.4 Supra, note 1174, decided to approach CNI President Dmitry Symes for help facilitating Ovens' request, recalling that Symes had some relationship with Kushner. Note 1175. At the time, Symes was lobbying the Trump transition team on Burt's behalf to appoint Burt U.S. ambassador to Russia. Note 1176. Burt contacted Symes by telephone and asked if he could arrange a meeting with Kushner to discuss setting up a high-level communications channel between Putin and the incoming administration. Note 1177. Symes told the office that he declined and stated to Burt that setting up such a channel was not a good idea in light of the media attention surrounding Russian influence in the U.S. presidential election. Note 1178. According to Symes, he understood that Burt was seeking a secret channel, and Symes did not want CNI to be seen as an intermediary between the Russian government and the incoming administration. Note 1179. Based on what Symes had read in the media, he stated that he already had concerns that Trump's business connections could be exploited by Russia, and Symes said he did not want CNI to have any involvement or apparent involvement in facilitating any connection. Note 1180. In an email dated December 22, 2016, Burt recounted for Oven his conversation with Symes. Through a trusted third party, I have reached out to the very influential person I mentioned in Luxembourg concerning Project A. There is an interest and an understanding for the need to establish such a channel. But the individual emphasized that at this moment, with so much intense interest in the Congress and the media over the question of cyber hacking and who ordered what, Project A was too explosive to discuss. The individual agreed to discuss it again after the New Year. I trust the individual's instincts on this. If this is unclear, or you would like to discuss, don't hesitate to call. Note 1181. According to Burt, the very influential person referenced in his email was Symes, and the reference to a trusted third party was a fabrication, as no such third party existed. Project A was a term that Burt created for Oven's effort to help establish a communications channel between Russia and the Trump team, which he used in light of the sensitivities surrounding what Oven was requesting, especially in light of the recent attention to Russia's influence in the U.S. presidential election. Note 1182. According to Burt, his report that there was interest in a communications channel reflected Symes's views, not necessarily those of the transition team. And in any event, Burt acknowledged that he had added some hype to that sentence to make it sound like there was more interest from the transition team than may have actually existed. Note 1183. Oven replied to Burt's email on the same day saying, "Thank you. All clear." Note 1184. According to Oven, this statement indicated that he did not want the outreach to continue. Note 1185. Burt spoke to Oven sometime thereafter about his attempt to make contact with the Trump team, explaining to Oven that the current environment made it impossible. Redaction, grand jury. Including note 1186. Burt did not recall discussing Oven's request with Symes again, nor did he recall speaking to anyone else about the request. Note 1187. In the first quarter of 2017, Oven met again with Putin and other Russian officials. Note 1188. At that meeting, Putin asked about Oven's attempt to build relations with the Trump administration, and Oven recounted his lack of success. Note 1189. Redaction, grand jury, including note 1190. Putin continued to inquire about Oven's efforts to connect to the Trump administration in several subsequent quarterly meetings. Note 1191. Oven also told Putin's chief of staff that he had been subpoenaed by the FBI. Note 1192. As part of that conversation, he reported that he had been asked by the FBI about whether he had worked to create a back channel between the Russian government and the Trump administration. Note 1193. According to Oven, the official showed no emotion in response to this report and did not appear to care. Note 1194. 6. Carter Page contact with Deputy Prime Minister Arkady Dvorkovich. In December 2016, more than 2 months after he was removed from the Trump campaign, former campaign foreign policy advisor Carter Page again visited Moscow in an attempt to pursue business opportunities. Note 1195. Redaction, Grand Jury, including Note 1196. According to Konstantin Kilimnik, Paul Manafort's associate, Page also gave some individuals in Russia the impression that he had maintained his connections to President-elect Trump. In a December 8, 2016 email intended for Manafort, Kilimnik wrote, "Carter Page is in Moscow today, sending messages he is authorized to talk to Russia on behalf of DT on a range of issues of mutual interest, including Ukraine." Note 1197. On December 9, 2016, Page went to dinner with NES employees Shlomo Weber and Andrei Krikovich. Note 1198. Weber had contacted Dvorkovich to let him know that Page was in town and to invite him to stop by the dinner if he wished to do so, and Dvorkovich came to the restaurant for a few minutes to meet with Page. Note 1199. Dvorkovich congratulated Page on Trump's election and expressed interest in starting a dialogue between the United States and Russia. Note 1200. Dvorkovich asked Page if he could facilitate connecting Dvorkovich with individuals involved in the transition to begin a discussion of future cooperation. Note 1201. Redaction, Grand Jury, including Note 1202, 1203. Redaction, Grand Jury. Dvorkovich separately discussed working together in the future by forming an academic partnership. Note 1204. Redaction, Grand Jury, including Note 1205, 1206. 7. Contacts with and through Michael T. Flynn. Incoming National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was the transition team's primary conduit for communications with the Russian ambassador and dealt with Russia on two sensitive matters during the transition period: a United Nations Security Council vote and the Russian government's reaction to the United States' imposition of sanctions for Russian interference in the 2016 election. Note 1207. Despite Kushner's conclusion that Kislyak did not wield influence inside the Russian government, the transition team turned to Flynn's relationship with Kislyak on both issues. As to the sanctions, Flynn spoke by phone to K.T. McFarland, his incoming deputy, to prepare for his call to Kislyak. McFarland was with the president-elect and other senior members of the transition team at Mar-a-Lago at the time. Although transition officials at Mar-a-Lago had some concern about possible Russian reactions to the sanctions, the investigation did not identify evidence that the president-elect asked Flynn to make any request to Kislyak. Flynn asked Kislyak not to escalate the situation in response to U.S. sanctions imposed on December 29, 2016, and Kislyak later reported to Flynn that Russia acceded to that request. 7A. United Nations vote on Israeli settlements. On December 21, 2016, Egypt submitted a resolution to the United Nations Security Council calling on Israel to cease settlement activities in Palestinian territory. Note 1208. The Security Council, which includes Russia, was scheduled to vote on the resolution the following day. Note 1209. There was speculation in the media that the Obama administration would not oppose the resolution. Note 1210. According to Flynn, the transition team regarded the vote as a significant issue and wanted to support Israel by opposing the resolution. Note 1211. On December 22, 2016, multiple members of the transition team, as well as President-elect Trump, communicated with foreign government officials to determine their views on the resolution and to rally support to delay the vote or defeat the resolution. Note 1212. Kushner led the effort for the transition team, Flynn was responsible for the Russian government. Note 1213. Minutes after an early morning phone call with Kushner on December 22nd, Flynn called Kislyak. Note 1214. According to Flynn, he informed Kislyak about the vote and the transition team's opposition to the resolution and requested that Russia vote against or delay the resolution. Note 1215. Later that day, President-elect Trump spoke with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi about the vote. Note 1216. Ultimately, Egypt postponed the vote. Note 1217. On December 23, 2016, Malaysia, New Zealand, Senegal, and Venezuela resubmitted the resolution. Note 1218. Throughout the day, members of the transition team continued to talk with foreign leaders about the resolution, with Flynn continuing to lead the outreach with the Russian government through Kislyak. Note 1219. When Flynn again spoke with Kislyak, Kislyak informed Flynn that if the resolution came to a vote, Russia would not vote against it. Note 1220. The resolution later passed 14-0, with the United States abstaining. Note 1221. B. U.S. sanctions against Russia. Flynn was also the transition team member who spoke with the Russian government when the Obama administration imposed sanctions and other measures against Russia in response to Russia's interference in the 2016 presidential election. On December 28, 2016, then-President Obama signed Executive Order 13757, which took effect at 12:01 a.m. the following day and imposed sanctions on 9 Russian individuals and entities. Note 1222. On December 29, 2016, the Obama administration also expelled 35 Russian government officials and closed 2 Russian government-owned compounds in the United States. Note 1223. During the rollout of the sanctions, President-elect Trump and multiple transition team senior officials, including McFarland, Steve Bannon, and Reince Priebus, were staying at the Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida. Flynn was on vacation in the Dominican Republic, note 1224, but was in daily contact with McFarland, note 1225. The transition team and President-elect Trump were concerned that these sanctions would harm the United States' relationship with Russia. Note 1226. Although the details and timing of sanctions were unknown on December 28, 2016, the media began reporting that retaliatory measures from the Obama administration against Russia were forthcoming. Note 1227. When asked about imposing sanctions on Russia for its alleged interference in the 2016 presidential election, President-elect Trump told the media, "I think we ought to get on with our lives." Note 1228. Russia initiated the outreach to the transition team. On the evening of December 28, 2016, Kislyak texted Flynn, quote, "Can you kindly call me back at your convenience?" End quote. Note 1229. Flynn did not respond to the text message that evening. Someone from the Russian embassy also called Flynn the next morning at 10:38 a.m., but they did not talk. Note 1230. The sanctions were announced publicly on December 29, 2016. Note 1231. At 1:53 p.m. that day, McFarland began exchanging emails with multiple transition team members and advisors about the impact the sanctions would have on the incoming administration. Note 1232. At 2:07 p.m., a transition team member texted Flynn a link to a New York Times article about the sanctions. Note 1233. At 2:29 p.m., McFarland called Flynn, but they did not talk. Note 1234. Shortly thereafter, McFarland and Bannon discussed the sanctions. Note 1235. According to McFarland, Bannon remarked that the sanctions would hurt their ability to have good relations with Russia and that Russian escalation would make things more difficult. Note 1236. McFarland believed she told Bannon that Flynn was scheduled to talk to Kislyak later that night. Note 1237. McFarland also believed she may have discussed the sanctions with Priebus and likewise told him that Flynn was scheduled to talk to Kislyak that night. Note 1238. At 3:14 p.m., Flynn texted a transition team member who was assisting McFarland. Time for a call? Note 1239. The transition team member responded that McFarland was on the phone with Tom Bossert, a transition team senior official, to which Flynn responded, "Tit for tat with Russia, not good. Russian ambo reaching out to me today." Note 1240. Flynn recalled that he chose not to communicate with Kislyak about the sanctions until he had heard from the team at Mar-a-Lago. Note 1241. He first spoke with Michael Ledeen, note 1242, a transition team member who advised on foreign policy and national security matters for 20 minutes, note 1243. Flynn then spoke to McFarland for almost 20 minutes to discuss what, if anything, to communicate to Kislyak about the sanctions. Note 1244. On that call, McFarland and Flynn discussed the sanctions, including their potential impact on the incoming Trump administration's foreign policy goals. Note 1245. McFarland and Flynn also discussed that transition team members in Mar-a-Lago did not want Russia to escalate the situation. Note 1246. They both understood that Flynn would relay a message to Kislyak in hopes of making sure the situation would not get out of hand. Note 1247. Immediately after speaking with McFarland, Flynn called and spoke with Kislyak. Note 1248. Flynn discussed multiple topics with Kislyak, including the sanctions, scheduling a video teleconference between President-elect Trump and Putin, an incoming terrorism conference, and Russia's views about the Middle East. Note 1249. With respect to the sanctions, Flynn requested that Russia not escalate the situation, not get into a tit-for-tat, and only respond to the sanctions in a reciprocal manner. Note 1250. Multiple transition team members were aware that Flynn was speaking with Kislyak that day. In addition to her conversations with Bannon and Reince Priebus at 4:43 p.m., McFarland sent an email to transition team members about the sanctions, informing the group that Jen Flynn is talking to Russian ambassador this evening. Note 1251. Less than an hour later, McFarland briefed President-elect Trump. Bannon, Priebus, Sean Spicer, and other transition team members were present. Note 1252. During the briefing, President-elect Trump asked McFarland if the Russians did it, meaning the intrusions intended to influence the presidential election. Note 1253. McFarland said yes, and President-elect Trump expressed doubt that it was the Russians. Note 1254. McFarland also discussed potential Russian responses to the sanctions and said Russia's response would be an indicator of what the Russians wanted going forward. Note 1255. President-elect Trump opined that the sanctions provided him with leverage to use with the Russians. Note 1256. McFarland recalled that at the end of the meeting, someone may have mentioned to President-elect Trump that Flynn was speaking to the Russian ambassador that evening. Note 1257. After the briefing, Flynn and McFarland spoke over the phone. Note 1258. Flynn reported on the substance of his call with Kislyak, including their discussion of the sanctions. Note 1259. According to McFarland, Flynn mentioned that the Russian response to the sanctions was not going to be escalatory because they wanted a good relationship with the incoming administration. Note 1260. McFarland also gave Flynn a summary of her recent briefing with President-elect Trump. Note 1261. The next day, December 30th, 2016, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov remarked that Russia would respond in kind to the sanctions. Note 1262. Putin superseded that comment 2 hours later, releasing a statement that Russia would not take retaliatory measures in response to the sanctions at that time. Note 1263. Hours later, President-elect Trump tweeted, "Great move on delay by V. Putin." Note 1264. Shortly thereafter, Flynn sent a text message to McFarland summarizing his call with Kislyak from the day before, which she emailed to Kushner, Bannon, Priebus, and other transition team members. Note 1265. The text message and email did not include sanctions as one of the topics discussed with Kislyak. Note 1266. Flynn told the office that he did not document his discussion of sanctions because it could be perceived as getting in the way of the Obama administration's foreign policy. Note 1267. On December 31st, 2016, Kislyak called Flynn and told him the request had been received at the highest levels and that Russia had chosen not to retaliate to the sanctions in response to the request. Note 1268. 2 hours later, Flynn spoke with McFarland and relayed his conversation with Kislyak. Note 1269. According to McFarland, Flynn remarked that the Russians wanted a better relationship and that the relationship was back on track. Note 1270. Flynn also told McFarland that he believed his phone call had made a difference. Note 1271. McFarland recalled congratulating Flynn in response. Note 1272. Flynn spoke with other transition team members that day, but does not recall whether they discussed the sanctions. Note 1273. Flynn recalled discussing the sanctions with Bannon the next day, and that Bannon appeared to know about Flynn's conversation with Kislyak. Note 1274. Bannon, for his part, recalled meeting with Flynn that day, but said that he did not remember discussing sanctions with him. Note 1275. Additional information about Flynn's sanctions-related discussions with Kislyak and the handling of those discussions by the transition team and the Trump administration is provided in Volume 2 of this report. In sum, the investigation established multiple links between Trump campaign officials and individuals tied to the Russian government. Those links included Russian offers of assistance to the campaign. In some instances, the campaign was receptive to the offer, while in other instances, the campaign officials shied away. Ultimately, the investigation did not establish that the campaign coordinated or conspired with the Russian government in its election interference activities. 5. Prosecution and declination decisions. The appointment order authorized the special counsel's office to prosecute federal crimes arising from its investigation of the matters assigned to it. In deciding whether to exercise this prosecutorial authority, the office has been guided by the principles of federal prosecution set forth in the Justice formerly U.S. Attorney's Manual. In particular, the office has evaluated whether the conduct of the individuals considered for prosecution constituted a federal offense, and whether admissible evidence would probably be sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction for such an offense. Justice Manual, Sections 9 through 27.220, 2018. Where the answer to those questions was yes, the office further considered whether the prosecution would serve a substantial federal interest. The individuals were subject to effective prosecution in another jurisdiction, and there existed an adequate non-criminal alternative to prosecution, id. As explained below, those considerations led the office to seek charges against two sets of Russian nationals for their roles in perpetrating the Active Measures social media campaign and computer intrusion operations. Redaction: harm to ongoing matter. The office similarly determined that the contacts between campaign officials and Russia-linked individuals either did not involve the commission of a federal crime or, in the case of campaign finance offenses, that our evidence was not sufficient to obtain and sustain a criminal conviction. At the same time, the office concluded that the principles of federal prosecution supported charging certain individuals connected to the campaign with making false statements or otherwise obstructing this investigation or parallel congressional investigations. A. Russian Active Measures social media campaign. On February 16, 2018, a federal grand jury in the District of Columbia returned an indictment charging 13 Russian nationals and three Russian entities, including the Internet Research Agency, IRA, and Concord Management and Consulting LLC, Concord, with violating U.S. criminal laws in order to interfere with U.S. elections and political processes. Note 1276. The indictment charges all of the defendants with conspiracy to defraud the United States, count one, three defendants with conspiracy to commit wire fraud and bank fraud, count two, and five defendants with aggravated identity theft, counts 3 through 8. Internet Research Agency indictment. Concord, which is one of the entities charged in the count one conspiracy, entered an appearance through U.S. counsel and moved to dismiss the charge on multiple grounds. In orders and memorandum opinions issued on August 13th and November 15th, 2018, the district court denied Concord's motions to dismiss. United States v. Concord Management and Consulting LLC, FSUP 3rd, 38, DDC 2018. United States v. Concord Management and Consulting LLC, 317 FSUP 3rd, 598, DDC 2018. As of this writing, the prosecution of Concord remains ongoing before the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. The other defendants remain at large. Although members of the IRA had contact with individuals affiliated with the Trump campaign, the indictment does not charge any Trump campaign official or any other U.S. person with participating in the conspiracy. That is because the investigation did not identify evidence that any U.S. person who coordinated or communicated with the IRA knew that he or she was speaking with Russian nationals engaged in the criminal conspiracy. The office therefore determined that such persons did not have the knowledge or criminal purpose required to charge them in the conspiracy to defraud the United States, count one, or in the separate count alleging a wire and bank fraud conspiracy involving the IRA and two individual Russian nationals, count two. The office did, however, charge one U.S. national for his role in supplying false or stolen bank account numbers that allowed the IRA conspirators to access U.S. online payment systems by circumventing those systems' security features. On February 12, 2018, Richard Pinedo pleaded guilty. pursuant to a single count information to identity fraud in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1028A7 and B1D. Plea agreement, United States v. Richard Pinedo, number 1, 18 CR 24, DDC, February 12, 2018, document 10. The investigation did not establish that Pinedo was aware of the identity of the IRA members who purchased bank account numbers from him. Pinedo's sales of account numbers enabled the IRA members to anonymously access a financial network through which they transacted with U.S. persons and companies. See Government Sent Memo at 3, United States v. Richard Pinedo, number 1, 18 CR 24, DDC, September 26, 2018, document 24. On October 10, 2018, Pinedo was sentenced to 6 months of imprisonment, to be followed by 6 months of home confinement, and was ordered to complete 100 hours of community service. B. Russian Hacking and Dumping Operations. 1. Section 1030, Computer Intrusion Conspiracy. A. Background. On July 13, 2018, a federal grand jury in the District of Columbia returned an indictment charging Russian military intelligence officers from the GRU with conspiring to hack into various U.S. computers used by the Clinton campaign, DNC, DCCC, and other U.S. persons, in violation of 18 U.S.C. Sections 1030 and 371, Count 1, committing identity theft and conspiring to commit money laundering in furtherance of that hacking conspiracy, in violation of 18 U.S.C. Sections 1028A and 1956H, Counts 2 through 10, and a separate conspiracy to hack into the computers of U.S. persons and entities responsible for the administration of the 2016 U.S. election, in violation of 18 U.S.C. Sections 1030 and 371, Count 11. Netek Show, Indictment, Note 1277. As of this writing, all 12 defendants remain at large. The Netek Show Indictment alleges that the defendants conspired with one another and with others to hack into the computers of U.S. persons and entities involved in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, steal documents from those computers, and stage releases of the stolen documents to interfere in the election. Netek Show Indictment, Paragraph 2. The indictment also describes how, in staging the releases, the defendants used the Guccifer 2.0 persona to disseminate documents through WikiLeaks. On July 22, 2016, WikiLeaks released over 20,000 emails and other documents that the hacking conspirators had stolen from the DNC. Netek Show Indictment, Paragraph 48. In addition, on October 7, 2016, WikiLeaks began releasing emails that some conspirators had stolen from Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta after a successful spearfishing operation. Netek Show Indictment, Paragraph 49. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter. Redaction, grand jury. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter. B. Charging decision as to redaction, harm to ongoing matter. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter, including note 1278. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter. Redaction, harm to ongoing matter, from page 177 through 179, including note 1279. 2. Potential Section 1030 violation by redaction, personal privacy. C. United States v. Willis, 476 F3rd, 1121, 1125, note 1. 10th Circuit, 2007, explaining that the 1986 amendments to Section 1030 reflect Congress's desire to reach intentional acts of unauthorized access rather than mistaken, inadvertent, or careless ones. Quoting S. Rep. 99 through 432 at 5, 1986. In addition, the computer, redaction, personal privacy, likely qualifies as a protected one under the statute, which reaches effectively all computers with internet access. United States v. Nosal, 676 F. 3rd, 854, 859, 9th Circuit, 2012, en banc. Redaction, personal privacy. Applying the principles of federal prosecution, however, the office determined that prosecution of this potential violation was not warranted. Those principles instruct prosecutors to consider, among other things, the nature and seriousness of the offense, the person's culpability in connection with the offense, and the probable sentence to be imposed if the prosecution is successful. Justice Manual, Section 9 through 27.230. Redaction, personal privacy. C. Russian government outreach and contacts. As explained in Section 4 above, the office's investigation uncovered evidence of numerous links, i.e., contacts, between Trump campaign officials and individuals having or claiming to have ties to the Russian government. The office evaluated the contacts under several sets of federal laws, including conspiracy laws and statutes governing foreign agents who operate in the United States. After considering the available evidence, the office did not pursue charges under these statutes against any of the individuals discussed in Section 4 above, with the exception of FARA charges against Paul Manafort and Richard Gates based on their activities on behalf of Ukraine. One of the interactions between the Trump campaign and Russian-affiliated individuals, the June 9, 2016 meeting between high-ranking campaign officials and Russians promising derogatory information on Hillary Clinton, implicates an additional body of law, campaign finance statutes. Schemes involving the solicitation or receipt of assistance from foreign sources raise difficult statutory and constitutional questions. As explained below, the office evaluated those questions in connection with the June 9th meeting, redaction, harm to ongoing matter. The office ultimately concluded that even if the principal legal questions were resolved favorably to the government, a prosecution would encounter difficulties proving that campaign officials or individuals connected to the campaign willfully violated the law. Finally, although the evidence of contacts between campaign officials and Russian-affiliated individuals may not have been sufficient to establish or sustain criminal charges, several U.S. persons connected to the campaign made false statements about those contacts and took other steps to obstruct the office's investigation and those of Congress. This office has therefore charged some of those individuals with making false statements and obstructing justice. 1. Potential coordination, conspiracy, and collusion. As an initial matter, this office evaluated potentially criminal conduct that involved the collective action of multiple individuals not under the rubric of collusion, but through the lens of conspiracy law. In doing so, the office recognized that the word collude appears in the acting attorney general's August 2, 2017 memorandum. It has frequently been invoked in public reporting, and it is sometimes referenced in antitrust law, see, e.g., Brook Group v. Brown and Williamson Tobacco Corp., 509 U.S. 209, 1993. But collusion is not a specific offense or theory of liability found in the U.S. Code, nor is it a term of art in federal criminal law. To the contrary, even as defined in legal dictionaries, collusion is largely synonymous with conspiracy, as that crime is set forth in the General Federal Conspiracy Statute, 18 U.S.C. Section 371. See Black's Law Dictionary, 321, 10th edition, 2014. Collusion is an agreement to defraud another or to do or obtain something forbidden by law. 1. Alexander Burrell, A Law Dictionary and Glossary, 311, 1871. An agreement between two or more persons to defraud another by the forms of law, or to employ such forms as means of accomplishing some unlawful object. 1. Bouvier's Law Dictionary, 352, 1897. An agreement between two or more persons to defraud a person of his rights by the forms of law, or to obtain an object forbidden by law. For that reason, this office's focus in resolving the question of joint criminal liability was on conspiracy as defined in federal law, not the commonly discussed term collusion. The office considered in particular whether contacts between Trump campaign officials and Russia-linked individuals could trigger liability for the crime of conspiracy, either under statutes that have their own conspiracy language, e.g., 18 U.S.C. sections 1349, 1951a, or under the general conspiracy statute, 18 U.S.C. section 371. The investigation did not establish that the contacts described in Volume 1, Section 4, supra, amounted to an agreement to commit any substantive violation of federal criminal law, including foreign influence and campaign finance laws, both of which are discussed further below. The office, therefore, did not charge any individual associated with the Trump campaign with conspiracy to commit a federal offense arising from Russia contacts, either under a specific statute or under Section 371's Offenses Clause. The office also did not charge any campaign official or associate with a conspiracy under Section 371's Defraud Clause. That clause criminalizes participating in an agreement to obstruct a lawful function of the U.S. government or its agencies through deceitful or dishonest means. See Dennis v. United States, 384 U.S., 855, 861, 1966. Hammerschmidt v. United States, 265 U.S., 182, 188, 1924. See also United States v. Concord Management and Consulting, LLC, 347 F. Sup. 3rd, 38, 46, D.D.C., 2018. The investigation did not establish any agreement among campaign officials or between such officials and Russia-linked individuals to interfere with or obstruct a lawful function of a government agency during the campaign or transition period. And, as discussed in Volume 1, Section 5, A, supra, the investigation did not identify evidence that any campaign official or associate knowingly and intentionally participated in the conspiracy to defraud that the office charged, namely, the active measures conspiracy described in Volume 1, Section 2, supra. Accordingly, the office did not charge any campaign associate or other U.S. person with conspiracy to defraud the United States based on the Russia-related contacts described in Section 4 above. 2. Potential coordination, foreign agent statutes, FARA, and 18 U.S.C. Section 951. The office next assessed the potential liability of campaign-affiliated individuals under federal statutes regulating actions on behalf of or work done for a foreign government. A. Governing law. Under 18 U.S.C. Section 951, it is generally illegal to act in the United States as an agent of a foreign government without providing notice to the Attorney General. Although the defendant must act on behalf of a foreign government, as opposed to other kinds of foreign entities, the acts need not involve espionage. Rather, acts of any type suffice for liability. See United States v. Duran, 596 F. 3rd, 1283, 1293 through 94, 11th Circuit, 2010. United States v. Lachkin, 554 F3rd 709-715, 7th Circuit, 2009. United States v. Dumasi, 424 F3rd 566-581, 7th Circuit, 2005. An agent of a foreign government is an individual who agrees to operate in the United States subject to the direction or control of a foreign government or official. 18 U.S.C. Section 951-D. The crime defined by Section 951 is complete upon knowingly acting in the United States as an unregistered foreign government agent. 18 U.S.C. Section 951-A. The statute does not require willfulness, and knowledge of the notification requirement is not an element of the offense. United States v. Kempa, 529 F3rd 980, 998 through 999, 11th Circuit, 2008. Duran, 596 F3rd at 1291 through 94. Dumasi, 424 F3rd at 581. The Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA, generally makes it illegal to act as an agent of a foreign principal by engaging in certain, largely political, activities in the United States without registering with the Attorney General. 22 U.S.C. Sections 611 through 621. The triggering agency relationship must be with a foreign principal or a person any of whose activities are directly or indirectly supervised, directed, controlled, financed, or subsidized in whole or in major part by a foreign principal. 22 U.S.C. Section 611(c)(1). That includes a foreign government or political party and various foreign individuals and entities. 22 U.S.C. Section 611(b). A covered relationship exists if a person acts as an agent, representative, employee, or servant, or in any other capacity at the order, request, or under the foreign principal's direction or control. 22 U.S.C. Section 611(c)(1). It is sufficient if the person agrees, consents, assumes, or purports to act as, or who is or holds himself out to be, whether or not pursuant to contractual relationship, an agent of a foreign principal. 22 U.S.C. Section 611(c)(2). The triggering activity is that the agent, directly or through any other person in the United States, 1. Engages in political activities for or in the interests of the foreign principal, which includes attempts to influence federal officials or the public. 2. Acts as public relations counsel, publicity agent, information service employee, or political consultant for or in the interests of such foreign principal. 3. Solicits, collects, disburses, or dispenses contributions, loans, money, or other things of value for and in the interest of such foreign principal. Or 4. Represents the interests of such foreign principal before any federal agency or official. 22 U.S.C. Section 611(c)(1). It is a crime to engage in a willful violation of any provision of the Act or any regulation thereunder. 22 U.S.C. Section 618(a)(1). It is also a crime willfully to make false statements or omissions of material facts in FARA registration statements or supplements. 22 U.S.C. Section 618(a)(2). Most violations have a maximum penalty of 5 years of imprisonment and a $10,000 fine. 22 U.S.C. Section 618. B. Application. The investigation uncovered extensive evidence that Paul Manafort's and Richard Gates's pre-campaign work for the government of Ukraine violated FARA. Manafort and Gates were charged for that conduct and admitted to it when they pleaded guilty to superseding criminal informations in the District of Columbia prosecution. Note 1280. The evidence underlying those charges is not addressed in this report because it was discussed in public court documents and in a separate prosecution memorandum submitted to the acting attorney general before the original indictment in that case. In addition, the investigation produced evidence of FARA violations involving Michael Flynn. Those potential violations, however, concerned a country other than Russia, i.e., Turkey, and were resolved when Flynn admitted to the underlying facts in the statement of offense that accompanied his guilty plea to a false statements charge. Statement of Offense, United States v. Michael T. Flynn, No. 1, 17 CR-232, DDC, December 1, 2017, Document 4, Flynn, Statement of Offense. Note 1281. The investigation did not, however, yield evidence sufficient to sustain any charge that any individual affiliated with the Trump campaign acted as an agent of a foreign principal within the meaning of FARA, or in terms of Section 951, subject to the direction or control of the government of Russia or any official thereof. In particular, the office did not find evidence likely to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that campaign officials such as Paul Manafort, George Papadopoulos, and Carter Page acted as agents of the Russian government or at its direction, control, or request during the relevant time period. Note 1282. Redaction, personal privacy. As a result, the official did not charge redaction, personal privacy, any other Trump campaign official with violating FARA or Section 951, or attempting or conspiring to do so, based on contacts with the Russian government or a Russian principal. Finally, the office investigated whether one of the above campaign advisors, George Papadopoulos, acted as an agent of, or at the direction and control of, the government of Israel. While the investigation revealed significant ties between Papadopoulos and Israel, and search warrants were obtained in part on that basis, the office ultimately determined that the evidence was not sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction under FARA or Section 951. 3. Campaign finance. Several areas of the office's investigation involved efforts or offers by foreign nationals to provide negative information about candidate Clinton to the Trump campaign, or to distribute that information to the public to the anticipated benefit of the campaign. As explained below, the office considered whether two of those efforts in particular, the June 9, 2016 meeting at Trump Tower, redaction, harm to ongoing matter, constituted prosecutable violations of the campaign finance laws. The office determined that the evidence was not sufficient to charge either incident as a criminal violation. A. Overview of governing law. The United States has a compelling interest in limiting the participation of foreign citizens in activities of democratic self-government and in thereby preventing foreign influence over the U.S. political process. Blumen v. FEC, 800 F. Sup. 2nd, 281-288, DDC, 2011. Kavanaugh J. for 3-Judge Court, affirmed, 565 U.S. 1104, 2012. To that end, federal campaign finance law broadly prohibits foreign nationals from making contributions, donations, expenditures, or other disbursements in connection with federal, state, or local candidate elections, and prohibits anyone from soliciting, accepting, or receiving such contributions or donations. As relevant here, foreign nationals may not make, and no one may, solicit, accept, or receive from them a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value, or an express or implied promise to make a contribution or donation in connection with a federal, state, or local election. 52 U.S.C. Section 30121A1A A2. Note 1283. The term contribution, which is used throughout the campaign finance law, includes any gift, subscription, loan, advance, or deposit of money or anything of value made by any person for the purpose of influencing any election for federal office. 52 U.S.C. Section 30101-8A1. It includes, among other things, the value of volunteer services. 52 U.S.C. Section 30101-8B1. Foreign nationals are also barred from making an expenditure, independent expenditure, or disbursement for an electioneering communication. 52 U.S.C. Section 30121-A1C. The term expenditure includes any purchase, payment, distribution, loan, advance, deposit, or gift of money or anything of value made by any person for the purpose of influencing any election for federal office. 52 U.S.C. Section 30101-9A1. It excludes, among other things, news stories and nonpartisan get-out-the-vote activities. 52 U.S.C. Section 30101-9B1-2. An independent expenditure is an expenditure expressly advocating the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate and made independently of the campaign. 52 U.S.C. Section 30101-17. An electioneering communication is a broadcast communication that refers to a clearly identified candidate for federal office and is made within specified time periods and targeted at the relevant electorate. 52 U.S.C. Section 30104-F3. The statute defines foreign national by reference to FARA and the Immigration and Nationality Act with minor modification. 52 U.S.C. Section 30121-B. Cross-referencing 22 U.S.C. Section 611-B1-3 and 8 U.S.C. Section 1101-A20-22. That definition yields five, sometimes overlapping categories of foreign nationals, which include all of the individuals and entities relevant for present purposes, namely foreign governments and political parties, individuals outside of the U.S. who are not legal permanent residents, and certain non-U.S. entities located outside of the U.S. A knowing and willful violation involving an aggregate of $25,000 or more in a calendar year is a felony. 52 U.S.C. Section 30109-D1-A1. C. Blumen, 800 F. Supp. 2nd, at 292. Noting that a willful violation will require some proof of the defendant's knowledge of the law. United States v. Danielchek, 917 F. Supp. 2nd, 573-577, ED, VA, 2013. Applying willfulness standard drawn from Bryan v. United States, 524 U.S. 184, 191 through 192, 1998. See also Wagner v. FEC, 793 F3rd 1, 19, Note 23. D.C. Circuit, 2015, en banc, same. A knowing and willful violation involving an aggregate of $2,000 or more in a calendar year, but less than $25,000, is a misdemeanor. 52 U.S.C. Section 30109-D1-A2. B. Application to June 9 Trump Tower meeting. The office considered whether to charge Trump campaign officials with crimes in connection with the June 9th meeting described in Volume 1, Section 4.A.5, Supra. The office concluded that in light of the government's substantial burden of proof on issues of intent, knowing, and willful, and the difficulty of establishing the value of the offered information, criminal charges would not meet the Justice Manual standard that the admissible evidence will probably be sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction. Justice Manual Section 9 through 27.220. In brief, the key facts are that, on June 3, 2016, Robert Goldstone emailed Donald Trump Jr. to pass along from Emin and Aras Agalarov an offer from Russia's Crown Prosecutor to the Trump campaign of official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to Trump Jr.'s father. The email described this as very high-level and sensitive information that is part of Russia and its government's support to Mr. Trump, helped along by Aras and Emin. Trump Jr. responded, "If it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer." Trump Jr. and Emin Agalarov had follow-up conversations and, within days, scheduled a meeting with Russian representatives that was attended by Trump Jr., Manafort, and Kushner. The communication setting up the meeting and the attendance by high-level campaign representatives support an inference that the campaign anticipated receiving derogatory documents and information from official Russian sources that could assist candidate Trump's electoral prospects. This series of events could implicate the federal election law ban on contributions and donations by foreign nationals, 52 U.S.C. Section 30121A1A. Specifically, Goldstone passed along an offer purportedly from a Russian government official to provide official documents and information to the Trump campaign for the purposes of influencing the presidential election. Trump Jr. appears to have accepted that offer and to have arranged a meeting to receive those materials. Documentary evidence in the form of email chains supports the inference that Kushner and Manafort were aware of that purpose and attended the June 9th meeting anticipating the receipt of helpful information to the campaign from Russian sources. The office considered whether